The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN+.
Welcome to Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, creative advisor for the Second City. We are brought to you by Second City Works, which is the B2B arm of the world-famous Second City Theater. You can find us at secondcityworks.com. And this is more than just a podcast. It's about getting to the yes and moment in your work and your life. The term yes and is a key pillar of improvisation. It's at the front end of creativity. It's about building on ideas and making discoveries together. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tie and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is J. Walker Smith. Walker is executive chairman of the Futures Company, the leading global foresights and futures research consultancy, which is part of the Kantar Group of WPP. Fortune magazine called him one of America's leading analysts on consumer trends. He's written four books, including Rock of Ages and Life is Not Work, Work is Not Life. He is a noted speaker and columnist, and he got his doctorate in mass communications from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Walker, welcome to Getting to Yes And.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So the theme of my conversation with Walker today is change. So Walker, I was really enjoying digging into your various books and articles because not only do you have what I call cutting edge insights, you're a really good writer. And when I knew that we were going to be talking about change, I went looking for an overall theme in your work. But in the spirit of what I found when I went looking, I wanted to start with an insight piece that speaks to the way that experts see change and experts miss-see change. So you talk about all the buzz in the past year or past years about millennials and the rise of single households and how the changing trends in more single households was going to be a sea changer for marketers. But that wasn't the case. Because people weren't seeing the whole picture, right?
Right. Yeah, we think there's a bigger dynamic going on here that's easy to overlook unless you have the right perspective on what's happening.
Yeah, and so the typical, and what you wrote is the typical way in which we look for the next big thing is to scan for the small things before they become big things. So for decades, single households have been a small thing getting bigger. What everyone was ignoring, though, is the big thing that was getting smaller, which is early marriage.
Right. Yeah, the we refer to this as a vanishing point perspective. When you're trying to anticipate what's ahead, and you're just looking for kind of small signals or weak signals, as they're often called, before they get stronger, it's difficult to figure out what to look for.
Right.
You don't know if what you see is really important. You're not sure what part of the horizon you should be scanning. And really, if you get it right, you're just lucky. So the better way to do it is to kind of narrow your field of view. You still don't know exactly what to look for, but you don't have to look everywhere at once. And you do that by looking at the big things that are getting weaker or the strong signals that are beginning to fade. And I liken this to a big tree falling in the forest. If you want to look where all the new growth is going to be in the forest, you have to look for the hole in the canopy, because otherwise no sunlight gets through and nothing can grow. But when a big tree falls, suddenly there's an opportunity for small things to flourish. So when you think about this in the context of household structure, which is really what we're talking about here, single households is kind of one manifestation of a bigger trend. And the bigger trend is the increasing age of first marriage. And this has a lot of implications for a variety of different things, one of which is the rise of single households. So, for example, when I was, getting married in the 1970s and in the 1960s, kind of those baby boomer patriots a little bit older than me, we were all getting married in our early 20s. So we can you know, pretend that we were, you know, John Travolta dancing on the dance floor and living the high single life, but we really weren't. You know, most of us were young married couples with young kids in our early 20s. Today, young people are living their 20s as single people, not as young married couples with young children. The average age of first marriage, or I should say the median age of first marriage for young men today is 29 and change. They're almost in their 30s. Before they get married for the first time. And for women, it's 27 and change. Hmm. So this rising age of first marriage is what's given rise to this phenomenon of single households. And that's a bigger dynamic that has more implications for how things will unfold in the marketplace.
Right. But you can see how the limited view would take precedence for people, because I just think, you know, we're so used to our patterns, right, and recognizing a, right. a certain kind of pattern. And it's very difficult for us to find original patterns. And one, right. of the, one of the things that I always love about improvisational work is it requires you to be so significantly others focused on your partner that yet new patterns emerge. So when you are improvising, you're making all kinds of rich discoveries, and it's a very powerful elixir. Of course, then we get off stage and we forget all that and go back into our other behaviors. Yeah, but that's pretty normal. There's so much kvetching about millennials. I mean, this is like just all things that people do. And I was struck by your contention that you say differences are due to age or circumstance, not generation. Generations are about starting points.
Yes, starting points. So if you, you know, a lot of people criticize generational analysis, which we've done a lot of at the Futures Company over the years. In fact, just as a little footnote, Futures Company was a merger of two or three different firms, and one of the founders of those firms is a woman who's credited with inventing the term baby boomers. So we've been looking at generations and studying generations for a long time. A lot of people will criticize generational analysis by comparing different age groups and saying, you know, younger people think just like older people. There aren't any generational differences. And while that's true oftentimes, that doesn't actually reflect the generational component because different age groups or different cohorts will have gotten to that very same place through different trajectories because they will have started from very different places. So if you think about baby boomers coming of age in the late 1960s and the early to mid 70s, this was a period of time of technological optimism, economic growth and prosperity, you know, until we kind of hit the late 70s, boomers were able to kind of grow up in that environment. Very different period of coming of age than the kind of boom and bust environment of much more volatility and uncertainty that millennials have had to deal with over the last 10 or 15 years. Right. That's not to say that millennials and boomers won't have the same attitudes on a lot of things like, you know, taking risk or planning for the future or making decisions about home and family. But it is to say that baby boomers got to that place in a very different way than millennials did. And so I characterize sort of a comparison of age groups as being a static view of people, kind of where they are today, whereas understanding starting points of generations is the dynamic view, because you have to understand how people got to where they are today, and then that gives you a chance to anticipate how that trajectory is going to take them into the future.
Yeah, it's a very unique way of looking at it that I had not heard expressed before, and I love it because it accepts that things do change, which is the start.
Sure.
But it also acknowledges that the entire human condition doesn't change. Right. We marry, we fall in love, we get divorced, we have jobs, we lose those jobs. Right. All that stuff is the things that every generation or most generations in contemporary era have dealt with.
Well, and just to tie it back to what we were talking about a little bit earlier about age of first marriage, you know, when you get married in your early 20s, that's very different than getting married in your early 30s.
Yeah, I did both of those things.
Very different starting points.
Yeah, I did both those things. First marriage was like 22, yeah. 23. Second one was around 30.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, very different. It's funny with the millennial thing. I was in a conversation with one of my colleagues, and she had just moved into a new apartment. And she's like, "Well, I use Dolly," and I'm like, "What is that?" And she said, essentially, it's an Uber type moving service. In looking at the Uberall economy, you had a very keen insight,
right.
Which was, you said, if a brand is not a service today, its value needs to be tied to a service, and this service
right.
should convert a poor asset into a more valuable one.
Right. Right. Yeah, we're seeing a real shift in the marketplace. The demands on business are requiring that business leaders look at their asset base in a very different way. And the opportunity to create new businesses is being conditioned a little bit by what investors are willing to support and make some bets on. And so increasingly, you're seeing technology used to convert low-value assets or, in some cases, undervalued assets into higher-value assets. And this is actually a change in how you think about something like an idle car or an empty room in your house, if you will.
Right.
And then it puts competitive pressure on established businesses and established brands. And it changes consumer expectations. You know, people go, "Well, gosh, I can get a car on demand. Why can't I get, you know, my groceries delivered on demand? Or why can't my laundry be done on demand?" Now, all of a sudden, if you're making a laundry detergent, expectations about your category are fundamentally transformed by, you know, a completely different category. And so if you're trying to think about how to compete for the future, you can't just think about your product. You've got to think about how to tie your product to the kind of service that's going to be part of the expectation set that consumers have in the future.
Right. So I couldn't help think about this in terms of us at Second City, which is nearly 60-year-old business. But it, it heartened me because I was thinking that we have services that provide value and we have values that actually underpin our services. And part of what I think has been core to our success is that we have built all these new services in the areas of training and insights and content. But at our core, which is like our main stage theater that produces original
right.
comedy reviews through an improvisational yeah. process, that group has always been and will likely always be a group of 25 to 35 year olds. So that has been true since 1959 to now. And I used to always just think of this in terms of, wow, this keeps me contemporary with music because these guys always give me the new music to listen to. But I think it's deeper than that. I think when you have at your core that group and then the next group is allowed to come in, that's fairly rare for a business to be fueled
right.
Continually by that sort of youth, that youth idea, that youth mind.
Right, right, right. Yeah, I think that's true. And I think a lot of businesses, they grow, change character in ways that they don't recognize.
Yeah.
And one of the things that always happens is exactly what you just described, which is that businesses begin to move away from kind of rewarding the views of young, aggressive people who think differently
mm-hmm.
to rewarding the views of older managers for whom continuity as opposed to change is the higher priority. And frankly, just to add a footnote to that, I think that's a real problem for businesses in today's marketplace and looking ahead. I think the kind of change that we're beginning to encounter and the kind of changes that characterize the environment going forward, it's going to demand that businesses value change not simply as an input that they study and then try to figure out how to adapt to, but they have to value it as an output or something that they want to actively engage in with their products and their services. Because what they produce now, you know, at a very high sort of meta level is just continuity. You know, let me find out what the change is
yep.
so that I can keep doing the same old thing. As opposed to change that really is something that I want to create as a benefit or an output of my proposition.
Yeah, you talked about the change from study, act, study to act and react.
Right.
And I thought that was interesting because in improvisation, a few of the things we talk about are turning obstacles into offers and gifts, making mistakes work for you, and creating safe spaces to fail, which are all practices that would support that idea of act and react.
Yeah, sure, exactly. Yes, you know, the speed with which business has to operate these days really doesn't afford the luxury that we used to have of being able to kind of study and then, you know, make decisions at leisure. Today, you've just kind of got to do something, see how it works, and then react and respond to that in real time. And that's a major shift in how businesses think about what they do. It's not something that is an easy transition to make. And I think that accounts for a lot of what we see going on in the marketplace these days.
Right. Well, companies don't have a place to practice risk.
No, they don't. Yeah, that's a very good point.
And I think they need to, right? Because you're a single tweet away from disaster.
Right.
And, you know, and we're taping this just so you know. It's the first day of the Democratic National Convention, right?
Yeah.
And we just went from a week of like, oh my God, what's happening, to another week of, oh my God, what's happening. And it seems, I was on Twitter before, and I'm like, this is crazy in terms of the amount of changing storylines and you know, it's I don't know what we're learning. It's probably all too real time to really understand.
Yeah. Well, you know, businesses used to think about risk by trying to figure out ways in which they could keep the cost of failure low.
Yeah.
And that's exactly the problem that you just alluded to, which is that even for small acts or small changes or small things that you might do, the cost of failure can be really high. And it does make businesses a little cautious. Nevertheless, the companies that succeed really are those that just kind of act boldly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just, let's just do it. You know, if we make a mistake and get criticized for it, we'll just keep moving forward, as opposed to companies who do something, get a lot of criticism, and then kind of recoil from the criticism. That's just not the right way forward in today's environment. And it takes a different kind of mindset to just kind of keep pushing forward through all the criticism.
So you've been in this business a while, and you're in a fairly exalted position. How do you get yourself sort of change ready? How do you not rely on, like, I know all this stuff. I've been very successful in my career. I've got it. Is there a pattern breaker for you?
Well, the thing that I try to do is to disprove every assertion that I make. So a lot of what we do at the Futures Company is try to help our clients anticipate things that might emerge so they can be more prepared for any eventuality. But as we do that, I try to make a deliberate point of trying to find contrary evidence for everything that we conclude or any of the kind of claims that we make. Because there is a really bad habit that a lot of people have and that, you know, we're not free of either, and that is sort of confirmation bias. You know, you get a hypothesis, you go out and you start trying to see if there's evidence out there to support your hypothesis. And when you do that, the only thing you're ever going to see is stuff that supports what you already believe. And you're going to dismiss all of the contrary evidence. You're either not going to look for it, or when you see it, you're going to dismiss it. The only examples that you'll keep, the only articles that you'll store are all the things that agree with you. So I try to make a deliberate habit of finding contrary evidence. Mm-hmm. Almost to try and disprove what I'm saying. And if I can sort of battle my way through all the examples that don't quite fit with what I'm trying to assert, then I feel a little bit more confident about the things that we say.
Yeah, I remember when I first read Danny Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow, I think that was the moment for me that was like, oh, okay, I need to look at things very different, because there's also availability bias. There's all kinds of biases we have. And Kahneman's book, I mean, to me, I keep telling all the people in the improv community, you have to read this, because our work are practices to avoid doing all the things that he's talking about.
Right, yeah. You know, there's another really good book, too, by a guy by the name of Duncan Watts, and the title of the book is Everything is Obvious, you know, subtitle, Once You Know the Answer.
Right.
It's about the same kind of thing. How do you go about the process of doing research, managing a business, you know, without all the kind of limitations that, that Kahneman describes of kind of gut instinct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's hard work, I'll tell you that.
Before
we sort of were entering the sort of ending stretch here, but I do want to talk to you, because you talk about kinship. And I think I know what you mean, because it's in the context, I believe, of the fact that the consumer, you know, no longer has this like relationship with brand, that this is about social currency, right? And belonging to that kind of community.
Yeah. So one of the ways we encourage our clients to think a little bit differently is to say, is to remind them that the concept of a one-to-one relationship with a brand is a metaphor, not a reality. And it was a metaphor introduced in the 1980s to describe a sort of a different set of rules to guide how you should engage with people in the marketplace. But people don't want to really have a relationship with you.
Of course not.
And in fact, social media are, prime evidence that people would rather create things to have relationships with other people that don't necessarily include brands. And so what we say to our clients is there is an opportunity out there for brands that want to deliver a different kind of benefit, not a closer relationship with your brand, but social currency that people can spend with one another. How can you be a brand that enables people to develop closer connections with other people as opposed to a deeper relationship with your brand? Because that's where people, want to engage. They want to engage with other people. They don't want to engage with your brand. And I think there's an opportunity there. Some brands have done a little bit of that, but there's a bigger opportunity there that I think is only going to get bigger as time goes by.
Yeah, and I would think even more true among digital natives. That the human connection becomes even more. We always forget it's about the people. That could be this entire podcast. Every conversation we have, whether it's talking to a CEO or an artist, whether you forget that it's about the people, how people behave, the way that they don't behave rationally, and then planning for that. And you can only plan so much, so you have to figure out how to work that into the moment.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Walker, one of the things we always end the podcast with is we ask our guests for a yes and story, a moment from their life, maybe work or not, where they could have said no, but they said yes and. Do you have one of those for us?
Well, I have a kind of a short one that's a little bit of a tattletale on myself. But
love it.
I used to run, I don't run as many staff meetings as I used to, but back in the days when I was managing larger staffs and running staff meetings, I always treated it as kind of a no-nonsense drill, and mistakes were called out, not tolerated, and this was all about, getting things done in a very focused and hard way. And one day, showed up in my email inbox, a little attachment, with an article about another manager who was being sued for harassment because as a way of enforcing discipline in his staff meetings, anyone who would come unprepared or would have kind of the wrong answer would be punished by being made to crawl down underneath the table and sit on all fours underneath the table for the duration of the staff meeting.
Oh, no.
I read this and I went, am I being compared to this guy?
Oh, no.
And suddenly, I just kind of burst out laughing. So, I could have just said, what is this? But instead, I kind of did, a little yes and moment, which was, okay, let's sort of take this and build on it. So I went to the next staff meeting. I said, okay, got your message, and I tell you what we're going to do. In the future, we're going to run these meetings a little bit differently. And if I get over-demanding in ways that you find to be inappropriate, then you tell me, and I will go sit underneath the table for the duration of the staff meeting. So it's all up to you. Tell me when I've crossed the line. And when I cross the line, this is what I'll do. And when everybody realized I was kind of serious, we all had a little good laugh about it. And then it kind of took the tension out of the air, because I had kind of gotten a message, and I had, you know, in my way, asked for a little forgiveness. And from there, we were able to create a much more productive working relationship. They were willing to take more risk. We could have a little more humor in the meetings, and things just ran better after that.
Did you ever have to go under the table?
No, they did spare me that humiliation. So,
oh, this is such a happy ending. This is great.
I guess I learned my lesson. Yeah.
Jay Walker Smith, thank you for joining us on Getting to Yes And.
Yes, thank you very much.
You guys can find out all the information about Walker's great company at thefuturescompany.com. We'll see you next week on Getting to Yes And.
Well, I've been working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop, about to slip down. Working in a coal mine, going down, down. Working in a coal mine, whoop.
This is Second City Works, Getting to Yes And. You can find us at WGNplus.com. You can stream us on the WGN Plus app, or you can find us on iTunes. See you next week.